BP is working to roll out EV charging hubs in the UK. And we're keeping oil and gas flowing from the North Sea. It's and, not or. That's how BP is backing Britain. While today we're mostly in oil and gas, we increased the proportion of our global annual investment that went into our lower carbon and other transition businesses from around 3% in 2019 to around 23% in 2023. bp.com/and, not or.
At the end of 2022, a corruption scandal shook the EU to its core.
Qatargate.
The Qatargate corruption scandal.
Lawmakers were arrested, accused of taking bribes from Qatar. But then, the case hit a wall, leaving us with lots of questions in an election year. Is the European Parliament for sale? And if so, what will it take for the EU to clean up its act? I'm Valentina Pop, and from the Financial Times, this is Untold, Power for Sale, coming May 29th.
Starmer calls Sunak a jumped-up milk monitor. The Tories call Starmer a serial promise breaker. Welcome to a week of election battle lines. I'm Lucy Fisher, and this is Political Fix from the Financial Times. Coming up, brace for a very long election campaign. We'll hear what each side's proposing. And to discuss it all, I have here in the studio with me my colleagues Miranda Green. Hi, Miranda.
Hello, Lucy.
And Jim Pickard. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Plus, a little later, we'll be joined by the FT's Peter Foster to talk about the really bleak outlook for the UK university sector. So, Miranda, Jim, let's kick off with the phony war that commenced in earnest this week. It's the shadow war before the real election campaign. On Monday, we had Sunak trying to draw up dividing lines with Labour on defence and accusing Labour of trying to depress its way to victory by talking down the country. We'll come on to that. On Thursday, we had Keir Starmer's big pledge card launch, 6 vows spanning the economy, NHS, immigration, energy, crime and education. So let's take that first. Jim, I know you were covering that for the paper. Just take us through what the vows were and give us your thoughts. What's the point of these pledge cards?
So a lot of people saw echoes in Keir Starmer's launch on Thursday on the 1997 election, where Tony Blair obviously sailed to victory and he just happened to have a pledge card with 5 very clear promises, fully funded, nothing to scare the horses, and you could fit it on a little card. And Keir Starmer's coming up with something similar, except it has 6 pledges, which is breaking the golden rule of politics, which is that you should always have an odd number of promises and vows and things like that. And the reason they've gone from 5 to 6 from what was previously their 5 missions is that they have added immigration. Eagle-eyed listeners will have spotted that immigration was not a mission, but tackling the small boats with some new sort of beefed up border force thing is a new... He's calling something weird. He's calling them my steps, my first steps, like
yeah.
He's a toddler.
Yeah. Our producer thought it sounded like a nursery school programme.
Completely.
I think the opposite. I think it's overambitious because it sounds like first steps of a sort of 10-year plan to me. Mm. This sounds to me like Labour rolling the pitch to argue for 10 years in power.
Well, that's what they want you to think. Well, and they've impressed upon us that these are not the be-all and end-all of what a Labour government would do. And of course, they will do their usual manifesto, which will be endless screens of text that only the sort of the bubbly people like us will read.
And you skipped past, Jim, the Ed Stone, Ed Miliband's attempt in between New Labour and Keir Starmer to cast in concrete, literally, his vows in that big slab of stone that they couldn't get out of the car park. It was so heavy. Miranda, interesting that on the posters, and they're going to be put in battleground seats, quite interesting some of the places they've been putting their guide to all of us on places that they're really looking to pick up their target seats, Swindon, Doncaster, Norwich and so forth. That Starmer is very much, takes up half the billboard, doesn't he? That picture of him looking very stern with the glasses on, sleeves rolled up.
Yeah, which is interesting because it means in a sense they've taken the fight to the electorate, because one of the things that all the focus groups tell us again and again is that Starmer kind of lacks definition in the minds of the voters in terms of what he actually stands for. So they want to associate Starmer with potential delivery of these priorities that they think are the voters' priorities. You know, I think that sort of idea, they actually called it a down payment, didn't they? They said, this is not all we will achieve, it's a down payment, which again speaks to a kind of ambition for longer in power than one term. But I think there is a slight problem here, and I've thought this since the party conference season, actually, in the autumn, which is that the parties are all slightly obsessed with this idea of retail policies in the jargon, which is what do we put on the leaflet, what do we talk about on the doorstep? And what you end up with is you end up with what we heard from Labour this week, which is, for example, 6,500 more teachers, 40,000 more doctor's appointments. It's a number, but does that number really mean much? It gives you a sort of stick with which to beat yourself if you can't deliver it, but also it's a sort of slightly meaningless. People just want the service to be working. They don't want to be told that across the country there will be 6,500 more teachers, which isn't very many anyway. I think the policy conversation gets a bit messy when they're looking for something that detailed to put on a pledge card. When you look back, Jim flagged the really important example of what Labour did in 1997, and they were really simple. It was like smaller class sizes.
Funny you say that, because I was chairing an event this week with Margaret Hodge, the grandee of Labour, was one of the new Labour ministers who came in 97. And she was telling me that actually she felt, you know, that the pledges had been a mistake and that they'd realised really quickly they got the targets wrong, specifically around class sizes and the NHS waiting lists.
Well, absolutely, because waiting lists don't matter. That's how you manage demand. What matters is waiting times. But actually, I think the whole political class picked up on that. And now, if you look at it, the emphasis is on times, even from the government. Yeah.
So her point was that you make these pledges in haste at your peril. You know, once you've got them, you're stuck with them. And, you know, you have these targets that you feel you need to give specific numbers for the press, for commentators to feel there's some, you know, flesh on the bone of these vows. And then sometimes they aren't the right targets to achieve the desired outcome, which of course is improved standards.
So one of the things that Keir Starmer was challenged on his event in Thurrock was, you know, is this not very ambitious? And he kind of took that argument head on. He said, no, if you look at our attempt to have clean energy by 2030, that's actually really ambitious. Mm-hmm. And yes, industry experts think it's basically impossible. But there are other things that were part of that announcement that I would say are probably less transformative when you actually look at the details. So, for example, they're going to have 6,500 extra teachers. Somebody has sent me this statistic suggesting that this is enough to give each school in the UK 0.2 of a new teacher.
Yeah, exactly.
And increases overall teacher numbers by just 0.3%.
So what is the point of including a specific number at that point?
Because the typical voter is not looking at that stat.
Well, I must say,
I think it undermines trust in the end, actually.
To my mind, 6,500 new teachers sounds a lot.
So it's a big army of teachers.
It's a big army, even though it's a
it felt quite good to me until someone sent me that stat and then I changed my mind.
Jim, to my mind, something very striking not on the pledge card is anything around Labour's pledge on workers' rights. Now, you've been writing a lot about how the party has diluted its initial programme to beef up workers' rights after a lot of lobbying from business, concern from some of the corporates. There's been a big meeting with the union barons and Starmer this week, but it hasn't erupted into the big row some of us were expecting.
So to understand what's happening here, you have to go back to 2021, where most of us weren't paying total concentration on Labour policy because they were behind in the polls and we were in the middle of a pandemic. And therefore, generally, the world wasn't looking that closely at what Labour was doing. And they came up with a huge list of policies in a Green Deal, New Deal for working people, which was basically the dream wish list of what trade unions want from a Labour government. And you could not have wished, if you were a union baron, for a more union-friendly list of policies, including reversing all the anti-union legislation carried out by Conservative governments for the last 8 years. And then a load of 30, 40, 50 policies, including things like scrapping 0 hours contracts, scrapping fire and rehire, giving everyone a right to switch off from work in the evenings and at the weekends, and also having something called fair pay agreements, which would be collective bargaining agreements for every single industry and part of the economy. And in the last 3 years, as Labour's got closer to power, they have diluted an awful lot of this stuff. And a lot of the dilution occurred at something called the National Policy Forum about a year ago, where the unions met with Labour. And a lot of this stuff, you know, they've kept the headline language. They're saying they're getting rid of 0 hours contracts. What they're actually doing is they're giving you the right to a contract based on the last 12 weeks that you did. You know, they are in theory still giving you a right to switch off. What they're actually doing is giving you the right to talk to your boss about whether you can not be called in the evening, to which the answer might be No, Jim, sorry, you're a journalist. So things have been watered down. And then the controversy was that we reported a couple of weeks ago that it was being watered down further, which has indeed happened. We got our hands on the new document where the language had changed. They're promising a big old consultation. And instead of legislating within 100 days, they're going to start the legislative process within 100 days. And this got the unions angry again, and they started shouting at Labour. They had this meeting this week. Labour's tried to reassure them that they're sort of heading back to the compromise that they reached last summer, and some of these new concessions will be removed. But I think the proof will be in the pudding when we see the final document in a couple of weeks.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because the Tories, when they're looking for anything at all to attack Labour with when they're riding so high, will probably find it quite useful to see that Sharon Graham, particularly of the massive Unite Union, that's a big funder of the Labour Party, is happy with the direction of these policies, and that will worry business as well. So I think that that's sort of interesting. But also, I think they do have to stick to their guns on some of this stuff, because anything that they can deliver in the first year or so, well, less the first few months of a Labour government, that doesn't cost the public purse any money. Mm. You know, those policies will be at a premium because they've got to show action, they've got to show change. Mm. And of course, the cost of any of this is to business, not the Treasury.
I think that's really interesting, Miranda. And one of the questions I have is, what happens if Starmer gets a huge majority? You know, will that give him more leeway to kind of tack more to the left, or will it embolden him to sort of ignore some of the union's demands? I wonder what you thought about that, Jim.
I mean, I think in general terms, we know that if they do have quite a large majority, then we'll see a lot of the opposition to a Keir Starmer government coming from the campaign group of kind of Corbyn-esque, not necessarily Corbyn supporters, but the people who were Corbyn's friends and allies when he was the Labour leader. You know, they will feel emboldened to take on the party leadership head on all sorts of issues where Keir Starmer is too centrist for their tastes. I think all this stuff will happen, whether there's a massive majority or whether there's a small majority. It may not happen quite as quickly as they still claim. I mean, they think that this is popular with voters. They've seen in Rother Glen, it was like the main message in that by-election among Scottish voters, saying we're going to improve workers' rights. When you poll these things, Savanta did a poll this week, the polling firm, saying that each of these individual policies was really popular with Conservative voters. I wonder whether it's the sort of cumulative effect of having all these policies and having the unions loving them, which might give some voters second thoughts. I wonder. But I think what we've seen over the last couple of years is we've seen Labour, in its attempt to be really business friendly, nuancing a lot of these policies, making them less kind of blunt, basically to stop business from criticising them. And I think there was a feeling over the last few weeks that maybe all this kind of outreach to business has gone down so badly with the unions that we need to kind of adjust the language a little bit the other way. Mm. But whether or not they adjust the policy, again, this is, you know...
Yeah, it's a delicate balance, isn't it, that they have to strike on that one. But Sharon Graham, when she took over as head of Unite, she didn't really want to do the Len McCluskey day-to-day meddling in Labour politics, Labour Party politics. She wanted to be, you know, a bludgeon for workers' rights, right? So for her, winning this battle with the Labour leadership is core to her leadership of this hugely powerful union.
Mm-hmm. And talking of unions, like other outriders that we've been looking at the FT this week is Labour Together, the Starmerite think tank that is paving the way towards a Labour government. You know, it's bringing in some of the advisers, variously dubbed Morgan McSweeney's Wagner Group, which I love, and Sue Gray's Army, obviously referenced there to Labour's campaign manager and Keir Starmer's chief of staff, both very key allies of the leader. Jim, remind us, what is it and what's its purpose?
So Labour Together is fascinating because it's flown below the radar for nearly a decade now. It was forged in that period when the Corbynistas were in the ascendancy. You know, the hard left seemed to have taken total control of Britain's main opposition party, and therefore the kind of dishevelled, you know, demoralised Labour centrists got together and said, well, we just need a space where we can sort of, you know, think up ideas.
There was this... We'll cry, weep together.
Have a bit of a crying
therapy.
Cry into their beer. There was quite a memorable moment in the 2015 campaign where the candidates at the time, who I think from memory, Andy Burnham, Yvette Cooper, there were four or five of them. They all sounded exactly the same.
And Liz Kendall, let's not forget.
And Jeremy Corbyn sounded fresh and different. And basically the people behind Labour Together didn't want that to happen again. So they set up this think tank. It sort of flew below the radar. They got into a little bit of trouble with the Electoral Commission because of some non-disclosure of donors. And basically, they helped forge the Keir Starmer leadership campaign. Morgan McSweeney, formerly of Labour Together, ran Starmer's leadership campaign. And what we are seeing now is an acceleration of their activities from one person to 34 in the last 18 months. Their donations have increased tenfold. And they're doing a lot of heavy lifting for Labour, including, very unusually, paying the salaries of 9 new special advisors.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I wanted to bring it up. It's just, I find the whole thing so curious. Miranda, what do you make of them?
Well, I think some sort of project of this type was very necessary to Labour, because the main criticism so far has been that there are kind of, how should we put this politely, lacunae in the policy detail. And so having some serious people working away in the background, putting flesh on the bones, as you put it, Lucy, of the missions is really crucial to what might work in the first few months of a Labour government. And, you know, I think this is part of what you've seen since Sue Gray took over as well in Keir Starmer's office, is this whole project of how Labour will behave in government should they win, which we expect them to. This is absolutely fundamental to it. You need to have really clever people who've done the detail. You need to have the right people in those briefing meetings with the senior civil servants, apart from anything else, which happen in the run-up to an election. You know, the shadow cabinet gets these detailed meetings in Whitehall, and then you need the right people to be able to go away and work out how to tell the civil servants the policies you want to implement. I think the other kind of Labour think tanks that used to be really powerful in the old days, you know, the Blairite think tanks, maybe have their noses slightly out of joint about Labour Together. I think the whole ecosystem of Labour policy thinking will become much more important as the months of this year go on towards the election.
Well, our influence is only growing, so I'm sure it's one we will return to. Well, we've discussed Labour and Keir Starmer, but it was, of course, Rishi Sunak who kicked off the shadow war this week with a big set-piece speech to the Policy Exchange think tank. Jim, take us through his messaging.
The message seemed to basically be that we are facing a world full of terrors, the likes of which we've not seen before. Artificial intelligence, Russia, China, dictators, wars. It sounds pretty grim. And there's this line where he talks about, you know, there's going to be more change in the next 5 years than we've had in the last 30, which I don't really like the sound of that. But he's obviously presenting himself, the Conservative Party, as the solution to these malign things coming down the tracks. The problem with it, though, a little bit, I would say, is that some of his solutions didn't really stand up to scrutiny. So, for example, he's saying we will get back up to 2.5% of GDP, defence spending, by the end of the decade, unlike those horrendous wimps in the Labour Party. But the Labour Party have also said they want to get up to 2.5% and they'll fund it sooner or later. So it's not quite the dividing line that Rishi Sunak wants it to be.
Miranda, it struck me as quite a cheek that Rishi Sunak outlined such a grim picture of the world, the dangerous geopolitical situation, the dangers of AI, and then yet accused Labour and Starmer of trying to depress their way to victory and essentially talk the country down. And Sunak sort of pivoted in his speech to this sort of more hopey-changey, uplifting message. We know what he's trying to do, of course. It's the classic Boris Johnson boosterism. But can Rishi Sunak actually pull it off? He's quite flat in his delivery, isn't he?
No, he's not a Tigger, is he? He's not a natural Tigger, although he describes himself as very glass half full, I think, in interviews. But this whole, you know, what is it, the Cat Stevens strategy, it's a wild world, you know, you're better off with us. The implication there is always Labour are an unknown danger. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of really fundamental option to fight an election campaign on better the devil you know. So I think that's what was really going on. And he had that slightly strange sort of John the Baptist role for David Cameron a few days previously, who'd made a video talking about our dangerous world, you know, and in his role as Foreign Secretary saying there are wars in Europe on our doorstep. Only we will guide Britain through these stormy waters. So this is clearly a theme that they're trying to develop as a sort of parallel argument. On the economy, you're safer with us, because it's turning the corner and we'll get you there. Labour are too dangerous, untested, spendthrift socialists. And on the difficulties in the sort of geopolitical world, we're also the sort of safer option. I mean, in a sense, they're both trying a similar pitch. Labour is saying our strategy for the economy is securenomics. Starmer, in his speech in the autumn, talked about Labour offering shelter in the storm. And now we have Sunak and Cameron trying to argue that in a dangerous world, you're better off with the Conservatives. Better the devil you know, always keep a hold on nurse, whatever the metaphor you want. It's tricky for the government, though, given the turmoil of the last few years.
And Jim, we've seen Sunak continue to roll out some kind of red meat policy for the right-wingers. This week it was on sex education.
Yeah. I don't have the fine details to hand, but the gist of it was that basically people will start getting sex education a little later in their schooling, and they will have less teachers telling them all about self-identification and trans issues and things like that. I saw an interesting tweet by someone saying that it's quite interesting that children are seeing porn younger and younger, and yet we seem to be having a state prepared to educate them about these things later than before, and I'm not quite sure that's the right way around.
It seems just crazy to say we don't want children exposed to age-inappropriate subjects. I mean, hello, the internet, have you noticed?
Peter Foster, the FT's public policy editor, joins us now. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
So, Peter, you've been writing this week about the Migration Advisory Committee. Just to recap, Rishi Sunak commissioned this committee, sometimes called the MAC, to look at the graduate visa route into the UK, whether it's working, whether it's being abused as a backdoor to come to Britain. The PM doesn't seem too happy with the answer. So give us a quick lesson. Can you remind us what the graduate visa route is, how many people are using it, what the MAC has found, and what the MAC is?
So the MAC is the independent advisor to the government on issues of migration, which we know are deeply political. The graduate visa route is something that was started in 2021 by Boris Johnson, in fact, and it's actually a reheat of something that was ended in 2012, and it was designed to make the UK education offer to international students attractive. And so what it does is allow students to have 2 years in the UK after they graduate. It's essentially a looking for work visa. They don't have to work, but most of them do to pay their way. And the Home Secretary, James Cleverly, got this idea that the route was being misused, that many of these so-called graduates were in fact going to do low-value jobs in care and in, you know, that they were making coffees and helping old people. They weren't the brightest and the best. And so the MAC was asked to investigate this very quickly, 14 weeks it was given. And I think rather to the surprise and irritation of Downing Street, and certainly to the surprise, I think, of the sector, it came back and said very clearly, number one, the route's not being abused. Number two, when they looked at these graduates, they found actually not, as James Cleverly had said, that half of them were going to work in the social care sector. It was actually about 20%. And when it looked at the kind of jobs that these graduates went into, it found that they looked very like the kind of jobs that UK graduates went into, and they earned at very similar levels. And they also found not that these people were a burden on society. They were net contributors to the exchequer. They found two, I suppose, wrinkles in the data. One was that the bulk of the increase had come from what they call lower tariff or lower ranked universities. And that led to a question about whether these graduates really were the brightest and the best. And I think those on the right of the Conservative Party, the Robert Jenricks and the Neil O'Briens, and indeed Downing Street, have a feeling that the route, even if it's not being abused, isn't attracting the brightest and the best. And I think that's what's driving Downing Street's view that it wants still, notwithstanding the MAC report, it wants to crimp this visa route, even though, and Jim will correct me, but even though the Education Secretary and Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, are pretty clear that they would not like to see it crimped. And there is a real little battle going on in Whitehall between Number 10 and some of Sunak's closest advisers and the Chancellor and the Education Secretary.
Well, as you say, really quite embarrassing for Downing Street after it commissioned this report, presumably thinking it would give them cover to pursue this crimp, as you call it. Where do you think it's going to end up? I mean, Downing Street has signalled quite clearly this week, following the report, well, it's highlighted HMRC data, completely different analysis suggesting that there are a lot of these people, graduates on this visa, who aren't in work, that the HMRC data suggests. Where do you think it's going to land?
Well, just on that point about that data, Downing Street have been very naughty about that. What the MAC said was that when you examine those graduates who've left, i.e. they've graduated, what do they do in the 2 years? What the MAC said was that about 70% of them had some kind of employment record. It didn't say that therefore the balance weren't, they probably went home. They just don't have an employment record. That's not the same as saying they're lounging about, sponging off the welfare state, which is the implication of what Downing Street is saying. I think there's a couple of really big issues here. Remember, the graduate route was started to make the UK competitive. Mm-hmm. Higher education is a big UK export. If you look, and the MAC says this, at the offer that you get from Canada, from Australia, from Germany or the United States, it's very similar to our graduate visa route. In fact, our graduate visa route is more expensive. The fees are higher. The NHS surcharge is higher. And the route was there to make the sector competitive, attractive, because it's a global talent. And if you look at the data, when we had one of these schemes up until 2012, the UK sector attracted about 12% of the global education market in graduates. It dipped significantly. And when they restored it in 2021, it's just gone back to the 12% of market share that we had before. Now, if you think of the graduate route as a way of making our sector competitive, it's also absolutely vital to the financial health of our sector. And it gets ever more vital because the £9,250 fees that our kids are paying, as it were, domestic kids are paying, are deeply subsidised by these foreign fees. These students are not taking places off our kids. They're actually funding the places that our kids go to and funding the research in the UK's universities to the tune of about £5 billion a year. So if you want to be a global talent hub and a science superpower, etc., the graduate route is absolutely key to funding that sector because the government won't, as the MAC acknowledged, allow universities to put their fees up. So the Department for Education gave me a statement saying university finances are the business of universities and they need to manage them properly. But actually, universities are running a business, essentially, where they can't put their prices up because the government's capped them. And so as part of the government's own educational strategy, they were told, go and find about 600,000 students a year. And guess what? That's what they've done. And having done that, in order to prop up the finances of the sector, they've now been told they were doing the wrong thing. And when they say, well, if you really want to push this, and by the way, we're already seeing really quite sharp drop-offs in the number of graduates coming to study in the UK as a result of a previous change, which was removing the right of those graduates to bring their family members, who also, by the way, were not, there was no evidence they were sponging off the welfare state. We're already seeing a drop in numbers. And, you know, the Office for Students, which is the sector regulator, put out a report this week, which has a really bleak outlook for the finances of the sector. And it's basically saying if something doesn't change over the next 3 years, as many as 90% of English universities could be in deficit because the student fees have been frozen. They're running a loss of 2,500 on every single UK student, up to 5,000, the Russell Group says, by 2020, by the end of the decade. The sector is going to be seeing consolidation, mergers, course closures, really big cuts. For example, 50 universities are having cuts. 2 weeks ago, I was at the South Bank University. That's a university that it's lower tariff. It caters to a lot of people who've been to university or first people to go to university, mostly people from lower socioeconomic demographics and areas in South London. They just announced 300 redundancies because they can't fund their university on their current structure. And the government has to ask itself two things. The first thing is, if it wants to be a global talent hub, why does it want a visa regime that detracts, that makes the UK like a hostile environment for global graduates? But also, if it thinks that there are too many low-value courses, too many lower-tariff universities doing too many courses, it also has to ask itself, well, what is the provision for those people who aren't going to go to those universities because there aren't going to be places for them to go? And when you ask that question, you look at what they've done to the further education sector, they've cut it to death. So there's no offer from those people. So both from a kind of bottom-end socioeconomic point of view and a top-end global superpower, moonshot central global talent hub, they're crimping it on both ends. And I think that, you know, the sector, talking to the university chiefs, they are raging at what's going on.
Well, I know you've certainly covered the backlash from the Russell Group of 24 elite universities who've warned the government against axing this scheme for the reasons you've outlined. Also, the FT got hold of a letter from businesses like Rio Tinto, Siemens, Anglo-American to Rishi Sunak, again warning him that the UK's immigration policy risks undermining the university sector. I suppose my question to you is, would anything be different under a Labour government? What will change if we see Keir Starmer come into government for the university sector?
It's a good question, you know, and one that I'd love the Labour Party to answer. There is no indication that they would change the really big thing, which is that structurally speaking, the university system has had its fees, its income frozen for a decade. And so there's no indication, Jim might correct me, that they are going to allow a university to put the fees up, even in line with inflation. You know, you don't get clear signals when you answer that question. Are they going to put up the teaching grant? Last year, the Treasury changed the way that students repay their loans, which effectively shrunk what they call the RAB charge, which is the kind of unpaid debt chunk that the Treasury is on the hook for, effectively shrunk it right back. But none of that money was passed back onto the sector. So Rachel Rees will have to, you know, decide whether she wants to increase the teaching grant. But those are the kind of really big structural things that the sector is asking for. And as far as I'm aware, and I'm happy to be corrected, but as far as I'm aware, those things aren't at the moment going to change. I think they will be softer on this graduate visa route. And one possible compromise is that Rishi Sunak announces he's going to make all these changes, puts them in the manifesto, and then assuming they lose the election, they don't actually happen.
Well, we haven't really heard from Labour what their tuition fees policy is going to be. We've had them showing a bit of leg 6 months ago, 4 months ago. But where are they going with that? We literally don't know at all. And of course, if they were to put up the cap, it would be pretty unpopular with young people, and I guess with a lot of their parents as well. One thing I wondered if I could just ask you was, you know, the wider background to this, of course, is immigration as a pressure point for the Conservative administration, of course, for the incoming Labour government. And there was that video put out by Robert Jemrick a few days ago, which it was basically talking about just the volume of people coming to this country and how that had changed in the last 25 years compared to the 25 years before 1997. And I thought it was quite articulate. I thought it was quite thought-provoking. You're more of an expert on this issue than me. What did you make of the Jemrick intervention?
You know, I think it is compelling, and it begs a question, because the one area, for example, that the MAC says this does put pressure on, so these graduates, they fund our university sector, they're not a burden fiscally on society. The one area that they do put pressure on is housing. Now you can ask yourself, you know, and Labour might want to ask itself, is the answer to that question to crimp the number of international talented people who come and work in this country, or is it to build some more houses? And I suspect the one area of policy that we do have some idea in is Labour says it's going to build some more houses.
Absolutely.
They are going to do planning reforms.
But you can't do it overnight. You can't build the hundreds of thousands or the millions of homes you need. Even Labour, you know, basically their target is 1.5 million over 5 years. If they get there, it'll be quite impressive.
But underlying the generic Neil O'Brien approach is this sort of lump of labour fallacy, in a way, lump of immigration fallacy, that actually, you know, there's not much space on the island and these people are kind of clogging the pipes up rather than actually creating a kind of talent pool and an investment opportunity for the likes of Anglo-American
and Rio Tinto.
And
paying taxes, of course.
And by the way, paying their taxes. They're not necessarily net per capita GDP increases, but they are part of the UK being an open global society, which is kind of ever more important post-Brexit because we're on our own.
But do you not think it's stunning, Peter, the way that the university sector has lost the argument with the Conservative government? I mean, over several years now, because to take on your metaphor, it seems as if almost every Conservative politician you speak to now has a mindset of a kind of lump of education fallacy, i.e. this completely wrong idea that more foreign students means fewer degree places for home students, rather than understanding the cross subsidy, which is so basic to the sector's survival. And I think one of the things you would see with the change of government actually is just a far better understanding of how the sector operates and also the virtues of expanding access to HE. Because I think part of this is also driven by quite a strong ideological backlash against university expansion in the belief that it hasn't really benefited people in the way that it was supposed to. And in a way, a whole generation of undergraduates has been sold degrees that aren't worth what they should be worth in the jobs market. So I just think you know, from a Labour perspective, the whole topic of graduate skills, what they mean for our economy, and then that cross subsidy from the incoming students will be understood in a completely different way.
To pick up on that, I think Miranda's right that the Labour Party will understand it. I don't know whether the public will. So one of the difficulties here is that university sector is going to be facing a crimp, like it or not, right? You know, structurally they're going to be squeezed, and that means actually that the quality of the offer is going to be squeezed. And so out there in the public, people are going to be feeling, I'm paying my $9,250 and I'm getting a worse and worse deal. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you probably are going to be getting a worse and worse deal because the sector's got less and less money. And that will become, in terms of winning the argument publicly. The second thing I would say from a Labour perspective is to go back to this question about, if not higher education, then what is the offer for the further education offer? If you look at UK on OECD averages, we are the worst at educating the bottom third, the bottom 40%, right? The offer for those people is deeply unjust. It's deeply unfair because those people in the bottom 30, 40%, they almost have no offer whatsoever compared to the people at the top. And so if you're going to crimp, if you're going to have less people going to university, because Miranda's right, as more people go to university, naturally the premium it delivers on salaries shrinks because mm-hmm. there's more people with degrees. You have to ask yourself, well, what are you going to do for those people? Those people who might have gone to a lower tariff university, if you're really serious about taking that opportunity away from them, and the survey suggests that's where they want to go, you have to give them an alternative. And that means properly resourcing further education, technical education. There are good arguments for doing that, but it isn't going to happen overnight. You know, further education colleges are, I think, even in 2025, will be 30% less well-resourced in real terms than they were in 2010. And so if that's the direction of travel, too many low-value degrees, these people shouldn't be going to university. And by the way, there's quite a lot of snobbery involved in that approach. But if that's really what you're going to do, then you need to think, well, what is the offer for those people? Because right now, it's a pretty poor offer.
Well, Peter, thanks for going through all that with us in such detail. And you've got a new newsletter out that we want to give you a quick plug for.
Oh, yeah, that's very kind of you, Lucy. Yes, so I used to write something called Britain After Brexit, but the decision has been taken that it's time to move on. Finally.
Britain After Brexit.
No. Be clear, Brexit's not over. It's an ongoing process, but
Hold the front page.
We're rebranding it State of Britain, which is a clever title, I think, because it's not just that Britain's in a state, but we're also looking at, you know, how the state's going to function. And just that includes Whitehall, that includes devolution, but also what you do to try and sort out the infrastructure deficits. And, you know, we've had 14 years, we've had all austerity, Brexit, a pandemic, a war in Ukraine, loads of political instability, new government, if the polls are right, coming in. And so now's the moment to kind of look forward to, you know, how we fix the state of Britain.
Brilliant. Look forward to reading it. You can sign up to that on the FT website. Peter Foster, the FT's public policy editor, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we'll be back after a short break with the Political Fix Stock Picks.
Hello, I'm Sumaya Keynes, an economics columnist here at the Financial Times. I'm hosting a new FT podcast. It's called The Economics Show. Every Monday, we're going to talk about what really matters in economics. We'll talk to policymakers, professors, and some of the FT's biggest brains. We're going to take apart the world's economic problems and think about serious ways to solve them. So yeah, The Economics Show, launching May 20th, available wherever you get your podcasts. We won't waste your time.
Miranda, Jim, we're coming to the end of this episode of Political Fix. Let's have your stock picks. Miranda, who are you buying or selling?
I want in my portfolio a justice secretary, but I'm afraid I'm going to sell Alex Chalk, the current justice secretary. I actually think he's a very good minister, but unfortunately he is at the centre of this storm over a sentencing bill, over a prisons overcrowding crisis, which is leading to emergency measures releasing prisoners early. The right of the Tory party is not happy about that. The tabloids are not happy about that. It's allowed Keir Starmer to attack Rishi Sunak at PMQs for early release of prisoners who might be a danger to the public. Really having a very tricky time. And then as his shadow, you have a very talented minister, Shabana Mahmood, who, if she was allowed a go at the job after an election win, might be quite effective. So I'm going to sort of shuffle some justice ministry figures for my stock picks. How about you, Lucy?
I'm going to buy Theresa May. She very gamely came to address the parliamentary press gallery lunch. We have a lunch every couple of months and we try and aim high with our guests. And she came and she was just so full of sass and zingers. She was talking about her own book in the bookshops and sort of was joking. She'd been looking around. She'd seen Tim Shipman's quartet on Brexit in the horror section. She said that Liz Truss's 10 Years to Save the West book should be better named 10 Days to Save the West on the basis of her longevity in Downing Street, and said that that would be filed under sci-fi and fantasy. And then in the real zinger said that Boris Johnson's upcoming memoirs should be filed under current affairs.
Amazing.
On a more sincere note, refreshing myself with the details of her career, 27 years as an MP, and I think such humility in going to the backbenches, being a really dedicated legislator, constituency MP after having been Prime Minister, and I expect we're going to still hear from her in a judicious sense in terms of how often she intervenes regarding her commission on tackling global modern slavery. So, you know, I think she is a politician, whatever your party politics, people think will be a loss from the green benches in the Commons. Jim, who are you buying or selling?
I'm selling Paul Maynard, the pensions minister. Not that I had a huge stash of shares in him because of he's been...
remind us.
He's been punished
is he
by,
even listed?
Well, he's the thing. He's the pension minister and he's been punished by IPSA, the Westminster Expenses body, because it's some kind of arcane problem whereby he was using a photocopier in his constituency office to do some political work and instead of just using it for parliamentary stuff. And he has been told he has to pay back around £1,300. But the interesting thing about that sum is it's an awful lot similar to the amount of capital gains tax that Angela Rayner is accused of possibly not paying on a property deal over 10 years ago. And given that Rayner, who denies any wrongdoing, has been sort of chased by the Daily Mail with over 80 articles and the police are investigating her, you know, maybe this is an important sum and Paul Maynard is going to get similar treatment. What do I know?
Well, on that fiery note, Jim Pickard, Miranda Green, thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Political Fix. I've put free FT links in the show notes to subjects discussed in this episode. There's also a link there to Stephen's award-winning Inside Politics newsletter. You'll get 30 days free. And don't forget to subscribe to the show. Plus, please do leave a review or a star rating. It really helps us spread the word. Political Fix was presented by me, Lucy Fisher, produced by Audrey Tinlin, with production help from Leah Quinn. Manuela Zaragoza is the executive producer. Original music and sound engineering by Breen Turner. Cheryl Brumley is the FT's global head of audio. We'll meet again here next week.
Here at Bellingcat, we get to the bottom of things. From a global crisis to an underreported event, we find the facts using publicly available tools and resources, uncovering what is hidden on and below the surface. We connect the dots using social media posts, satellite images, and public records, and empower others to do the same by sharing how we do it. The ability to do so is only made possible by our readers, supporters, and community members. Care to join us? Learn how at bellingcat.com.